Hello and welcome to Cult Show with me, Robert Bounds, where today we're cracking the spine on the 103rd edition of Monocle magazine and taking a look behind the pages of the mag. In this month's issue, we travel from Bangkok to the Brecon Beacons for a bit of a book bonanza. We knit round to the singer Yasmin Hamdan's pad in Paris for a cup of something sweet, and we take a snapshot of various photography festivals around the world. On today's show, we'll be speaking to some of the writers and Monocle staff behind these stories to tell us what's what. So jump into this revolving door of artistic nourishment on Cult Show with me, Robert Bounds, right here on Monocle 24. Our first stop is in Wales via a long list of countries all over the world. The Hay Festival is one of the world's biggest celebrations of books. It was started in 1988 by father and son Norman and Peter Florence in the picturesque town of Hay-on-Wye, located between the Brecon Beacons and the Black Mountains, and known for its abundance of independent bookshops. Since then, Hay has travelled far and wide, with festivals taking place in Querétaro, Mexico, Cartagena, Colombia, and Aarhus in Denmark, to name but few. Georgina Godwin is a regular, chairing discussions with literary greats as part of her vibe. She wrote about the organisation turning 30 years old this year in the new edition of Monocle. I'll be joined by Georgina in just a moment, but first let's hear from the director of Hay, Peter Florence, about how he chooses where to take the festival next.
You've got to have a great context, whether it's a literary context or a city that is particularly well-versed in literature, or a town that's well versed in literature. Hay-on-Wye has 1,500 people. We've worked in Mexico City, which is one of the biggest cities in the world. You mix and match. You have to have the desire to explore a place. And just as you find different people attractive for different reasons, you find different cities, different locations attractive. But reading is genuinely universal. Everybody wants new stories. The joy of that is that it started off as a sort of way of following curiosity about the rest of the world. I mean, we are amazingly confident in our Anglophone literary culture, and yet less than 10% of the 7 billion people on the planet are English speakers, and everyone else has their Dickenses and their Austens and their Mantels and their Rushdies too. I mean, they don't have their Shakespeares. We've all got the same Shakespeare, but all those cultures all around the world are as rich as ours. So we were just curious to try and travel in them and find out more. We have boomed in Latin America by accident and with great delight, but Latin America is an incredibly volatile, rich, fertile continent, which, more than a continent, it's an idea, it's a linguistic idea, which is happening now and happening in really interesting ways. It turns out the simple need to sit around a fireside or on a picnic rug and tell stories and share ideas is universal. Who knew? Well, everybody.
Georgina joins us now. Thank you so much for coming in. Between all sorts of literary engagements, all the rest of it, recording Meet the Writers, stuff like that, Georgina. It's nice to have you on the Cult Show as well.
Well, it's lovely to be the other side of the microphone and to completely surrender all responsibility for having to think of the next question.
It's freeing, isn't it?
It really is.
So it's 30 years of Hay. You've written a wonderful piece in the June issue. Thank you very much for that. There are a million ways in which we could take this conversation, but how do you think the Hay Festival will be celebrating its 30th birthday? As in what style would it be fitting for it to be celebrated? Its 30th birthday.
Well, if there's one thing Hay knows how to do, it's to throw a party.
And few.
I can absolutely guarantee that there will be very, very many of those. I mean, not just the festival as a whole, but all sorts of offshoots, you know. And yeah. I think everybody with a sense of fun and artistic integrity, I want to say, but that sounds a little bit up itself, that lives in
Hay. I think
Hay.
A bit of artistic license is what we yeah. need, right?
Everybody in the vicinity throws their own party too. So as well as all of the official events, everybody is kind of hosting something or going somewhere. There's a nightclub going on after events during the whole period of Hay. And of course, you know, nothing's complete there without a glass of something in your hand. So
You mentioned Pinot Noir in your piece. Other drinks are available, listeners.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
In plentiful supply. So and this, in fact, some of the writers get paid in wine. You can choose if you want to be paid cash or if you want a case of wine. And so the sort of mark of hay is people staggering wearily onto the train, lugging these great cases of wine.
It's good stuff. I remember going on a press trip to Cuba once, and we were given a case of really quite nice rum, and most of it never made itself back on the Virgin flight back to Gatwick. I mean, it was one of those ones. It sounds good, right?
It's a very happy train journey.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to carry anything home with you. Drink your winnings. It's fine. And you've been going for a number of years, and you know the key personnel, Georgina, who you profile in your story. It's a brand now, not just a festival in a single Welsh town. But do you get the feeling that it is a mighty oak that's grown from a little acorn? Can you see the sapling still, or does it feel like you're speaking or you're part of a brand when you attend the Hay Festival?
Do you know, I think that all of the key Hay personnel would absolutely reject the fact that it's a brand. They don't see themselves like that at all. Although, of course, you're absolutely right. That is what it's become.
Yeah.
But very much it's still grassroots. Those little saplings have grown up, but the trees are most definitely there, not hidden by the wood at all. Perhaps pulped to make paper for more books.
Exactly. It's a dangerous analogy, really, to make, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, it was a tree, but actually they cut it down because you know what E.L. James is like. He eats them for breakfast, forests, soul forests. So that's the part and parcel of it. And there is something of sort of a brain's trust about the people that you profile, everything from the sustainability director to the founder, Peter Florence, and all the rest of it. Does it feel managed? What we want to know, I guess, is the vibe of the Hay Festival. Mm. When you turn up on that first Thursday or the last Thursday in May, but the first Thursday of the festival, do you bump into people you know all the time? Do you kind of keep yourself to yourself and kind of hunker down and see some talks that you want to see? What's the vibe, and how do you survive it?
Do you know, it's absolutely fabulous. I usually drive up there with my dog in the back of the car, and in we rush to the green room because there are all of our friends, and it's so fabulous to see the whole kind of, not just British, but international writerly community, publishing community there. And you walk in and you'll see, I don't know, Elif Shafak in one corner, you'll see David Baddiel in another, Stephen Fry holding court over there, and suddenly there are all of these people that, even if you don't know them personally, of course they're on your radar. And it's wonderful just to feel included in all of that within the space of the green room. Now, of course, I acknowledge that that's an enormously privileged space to be in, but for ordinary people coming who don't have access to that, there's still that sense, because all of those people are out there, they're mingling with the crowd, and then of course you can go and sit down and listen to them for an hour and then have a private chat with them when they sign your book. So it's very much a community feeling for those of us involved backstage, so to speak, but also for the crowd.
And talk about the crowd. What kind of people go to Hay? I mean, I suppose, well, you can tell me this. I'm kind of thinking they've changed over the last 30 years from hardcore bookworms to people that kind of like a party that have heard it in passing. I guess there's obviously media sponsorship of this event. Newspapers support it, so people go as part and parcel and the propaganda of that, I suppose. Who is the Hay attendee?
Mm. As I say in the piece, as Peter Florence, quoting Peter Florence, he said everyone from shelf stackers to hedge funders. But actually, I mean, you're right about the media. There's a big media contingent. So as well as all the writers one knows, there's all the kind of press friends. But on top of that, I think what's happened for me, the shift that I've seen, is that as festivals, big festivals, music festivals like Glastonbury or the Isle of Wight, that kind of thing, increase in importance and people realise what fun a festival is, it doesn't really matter what the festival's celebrating. People love coming together and being a part of something. And so you're seeing lots of people who might perhaps have gone to Glastonbury or Reading there too, because they realise that the whole experience is so fabulous, alongside your traditional literary sort of wellies and barbers type that would go to Cheltenham and all the various other festivals. So you've got those traditional book lovers, you've got the much younger crowd, and then you see the crowd changing with the different authors or musicians or just thinkers that are on stage that day. I mean, for instance, I know this year Bernie Sanders will be there, so you'll get all the politicos coming up from London to speak to him. There'll be a big party afterwards. Everybody will be there to meet and greet Bernie and to listen to what he says. But that crowd who are coming to that are going to be completely different to the ones who'll come when I interview Paula Hawkins, who of course is the hit author of Girl on a Train, which has been made into a film. So she has a new book out, and one of the big kind of Saturday night set pieces is me interviewing her on in, I think, the biggest venue, which holds a couple of thousand people.
So you're headlining the main stage, is what you'd like our listeners to know.
Well,
that's what
Paula
I want our listeners to know.
Is headlining the main stage. I'm merely a conduit. And you know what? That's a really, really important thing to remember, because there are a few moderators and you know, a lot of us go up every single year and do, I don't know, 12, 15 events during the course of the 10 days. And it's really important to remember that you are just a conduit. People are not there to see you. And you just have to know that you're there just to get the authors to tell their best stories.
Because there's an interesting thing with that. The responsibility of an author to her public, like Paula Hawkins, what people are expecting her to say. And it's one of those funny things. You might know that great book by Mason Curry, Daily Rituals, which kind of taps into the daily rituals of writers, songwriters, poets, all these sorts of things, because they want to know that if they get up at 6:30 in the morning and have a cup of black Earl Grey, they too will be able to write The Information by Martin Amis or something. And thinking that, and I suppose there is something of the habit of writing. So maybe this is a question that kind of heads back to the audience. What sort of questions do people ask of the authors that they love? Because is there a Q&A section at the back of these talks?
And you know, it's always really nerve-wracking when you get to that. So the format of Hey is 45-15 normally. So 45 with me and then 15 with the audience. And as you're approaching that, I always try and give the audience warning that it's coming up so that they're thinking of their questions before you get there. The danger is people like to give statements. So particularly if it's an author that they really identify with, they'll stand up and say, you know what? Yes, when I was travelling in Rwanda, I also found X, Y, and Z, and go on for 10 minutes. And so, of course, your skill as the chair is just to shut that down as quickly as you can.
I think what he's trying to say is you're channeling your inner Dimbleby there.
It's difficult, but of course there are some fantastically good questions. And again, that comes back to another problem for a moderator, which is you have to leave the audience somewhere to go. If you ask all of the questions, then there's really not much more that people can ask about. I mean, of course, and there are all the set sort of things like writerly process, you know, what do you do where you work and all of that kind of thing. But I think because a lot of this is media sponsored and people are there also for a bit of excitement, you're also trying to get an author to say something perhaps slightly controversial or just a little bit out of the ordinary, something quotable. You need to be able to come away with a line that people remember. And that's, I suppose, the skill in asking the questions.
And in your own line too, right? I mean, because we've probably both been in a situation where we've been interviewing someone and they're telling the story as if it's a fresh story that you've heard. It was in the Times the week before.
Exactly.
And you're like, hang on, you've got to give me something here. And then what happened after that? Thank you very much for giving me that anecdote. So it's a tricky one. And let's end on a bit of a survival guide, Georgina. You're there presumably all of the week of it, week of the festival. What are the essential things you pack other than a corkscrew and a pair of Wellingtons?
I never take Wellingtons. They're far too inelegant. A charger, a phone charger, because of course you've got to be in touch. I would say that the most important thing, particularly for women, but I think men can take this too, is silk knickers, because they keep you warm when it's cold, they keep you cool.
Presumably the longer the better. I mean, I'm thinking as well.
I prefer them a little bit skimpy myself, Rod. And they just feel nice to touch. Not that anyone's going to touch them, but it's nice to feel them on your own skin.
Sounds amazing. I can't I need to get into that green room. Georgina Godwin, thank you for talking us through up the hills and down the dales, from tiny acorns to mighty oaks, silk knickers included, through 30 years of the Hay Festival. Georgina, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Books. Tick. How about some music then? One of our favourite releases this year is the new LP from Yasmin Hamdan called Al Jamilat. The Lebanese singer, who's now based in Paris, has been making music since the 90s in a duo of duos, Soapkills and Yas. It's only since 2012 that she's been recording albums under her own name, and this new one is her second offering. Andrew Muller met Yasmin in her Paris apartment, where they discussed her life in places from the Middle East to France to London and New York City. لو كنت مفلس لو كنت مبوس. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us. When we bumped into each other in the office and I said, oh, do you fancy going to Paris to interview Yasmin Hamdan? You're kind of like, I know this woman. She's an exciting prospect as an interviewee, because there are so many kind of ways, I suppose, you can take an interview with her. There is the difficulty of making music in Beirut, although she now makes music in Paris.
And elsewhere.
There's a certain amount of exoticism that comes with her. Is that deserved, or am I putting on my orientalist specs?
Not necessarily, no. That's quite a good summation of her career to date. Lebanese born, now lives in Paris, but the new album was recorded in about half a dozen different countries with a variety of collaborators.
And this is the way things are done these days. You can't just be a Parisian Beirutti artist.
No, you have to make it more complicated by recording in New York and London as well. The thing is, there's not a huge cultural overlap or culture shock, I don't think, if you move from Lebanon to France. Obviously, Lebanon was a French protectorate. Most Lebanese people do speak French along with Arabic. It's not that big a shift. It's probably a bigger adjustment for France rather than the incoming Lebanese person. She did make the telling observation, which I don't think is a massive spoiler for the piece, that she recently became a French citizen. And she said since then, every time she goes through any airport or any customs, yeah, she just feels she's instantly become blue-eyed and blonde-haired. So all of a sudden, she's much less interesting. But yeah, I think it's a fairly easy relocation. But that transplant does inform quite a lot of her work and quite a lot of the way she thinks. You end up, I think, seeing two sides of East-West cultural divide, and a divide which does kind of inform as well the films of her husband, Eli Suleiman, the Palestinian director. That is kind of, it became very clear talking to her that is one of the things that drives her. It's trying to make sense of both of those things, East and West, if you like, and her relationship to each.
Obviously, that brings us in to the nice musical conceit as well. You can have a 12-track album and six can be in Arabic, six can be in French, or they can be leading in either way. That is not the division of the language or the vibe of her new record, Jamalat. But you can kind of do that thing of, this is my Arabic side and this is my French side. And she rises to this challenge, doesn't she? There's good copy in this as well. Right?
There is. She does sing, I think, now almost exclusively in Arabic. The new album is all in Arabic. I think she made a reference to Arabic as being her emotional language. Yeah. But she did talk at length about the different sorts of Arabic, which was kind of illuminating to me because I don't speak any Arabic at all beyond the sort of pleasantries of good morning and thank you and two coffees, please. But she sort of talked about how she uses different dialects of Arabic because she grew up all over the Middle East for different tones and different sorts of music. And she did talk quite interestingly about the fact that obviously there is a different connection with the audience when she plays in Europe or the United States, and she's mostly playing to people who really don't know what she's singing about. And she said,
That's such a challenge for an artist, right? Hold people in the palm of your hand when they don't know what you're talking about.
It is a difficulty. And obviously she can sing. She is an extraordinary vocalist. But she did talk about how that's a different connection, and on some night it can feel weirdly like a more profound one.
Yeah, there's something of Latin Vespers of this. Well, you know what they're talking about, but you don't know why you like it,
yeah,
right?
I've sort of got the idea. I wouldn't want to sit a quiz on it, but yeah, that kind of thing.
Okay, it's her Evensong vibe. So you went to an arrondissement.
An arrondissement, it was.
I was going to scan my eye down the copy to try and find a little E somewhere. And
second, I think I'm okay. Right in saying. So quite, quite downtown.
Yeah.
It's a, I don't think I'm, I think I'm allowed
this is the,
to say.
Through the keyhole moment.
I think I'm allowed to say this out loud. It is an agreeable French apartment, typical Parisian apartment. It's I think it's three or four stories up. There's a nice antique kind of lift, if you're not terrified of weird antique wire contraptions that lift you up and down. And the video of the single off the album was actually substantially filmed inside that apartment and indeed inside that very lift. So you can get an idea just by going online and looking up the video. But it is nice. We did the interview mostly in the office, which I think is the room they both share to do work stuff in. And it's decorated almost exactly as you would expect a Parisian apartment room occupied by an Arabic couple would look. There's lots of bright carpets. There's lots of bright colours. There's souvenirs from home. There's a big poster for Eli Suleiman's film Divine Intervention, which I do want to mention because it still does contain, I think, two of the funniest scenes in cinema. Again, these are not spoilers for people who haven't seen it, but one's the one about the guy driving his car down the road and the other one's the guy collecting empty bottles on his garage roof. The denouement to both of those still breaks me up every time I watch them.
And this is something of both of their work, I suppose, that there is heaviosity and there is politics, as there's always inevitably seems to be of artists from this region, but they wear their learning lightly, it seems.
They do wear their learning lightly. That's a very good observation. Neither of them beat you over the head with anything they may have to say. I mean, I do feel a measure of sympathy for any Middle Eastern artist in any field, especially when, in this respect, especially as their work is received in the West, because everything is going to get passed for subtext or commentary. And I'm sure there are many, you know, Middle Eastern singers who just want to write a song about, you know, going to watch the football and having a drink. The Middle Eastern equivalent of country singers, I'm sure, would just rather do that. But I think there's an understanding that, especially if, I think from her and from Eli Suleiman, but I did talk about this with Yasmin a lot, that you kind of have to understand that if you are going to go out into the Western world, especially as identified as a Middle Eastern artist, it's never going to be possible to entirely escape some sort of ambassadorial role. Yeah. You're always going to get people going, please speak to me, if you would, on behalf of, you know, however many 100 million people constitute the peoples of the Middle East. Just, you know, I've got 30 seconds, explain everything.
Yes, exactly. That's why I wanted to ask you that question, because there is always that side of it. People want to interpret things, even in lyrics, in a language they can't understand. They want to, especially they want to read something evocative in that. And people are always interested in the nuts and bolts of these stories, Andrew. So you get off the Eurostar, you're going to have a nice spot of lunch in Paris. How long do you speak to Yasmin for to get enough good quotes? She's a quotable person. She's a friendly person. Arabic hospitality
perhaps insists that
there's an hour of pouring things and nibbling sweet things before you switch on the dictaphone.
She provided tea, which was very good, and there were actual Lebanese sweets and cakes.
Yeah.
Which she said had literally been sourced from Beirut. I think she was back quite recently, which I had no trouble believing. They were delicious.
Andrew Miller's not going to tell us how long it takes him to do an interview. It is a trade secret.
No, it was about an hour and a half or so, I think, there or thereabouts.
It's good stuff. It's a fantastic story. It is evocative of the woman in question. The new album is called Al Jamilat. The artist is Yasmin Hamdan. The writer, though, is Andrew Miller. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Finally, let's talk art. The Art Fair Photo London is still in its infancy, with its third edition kicking off next month. But the photography show has hit the ground running, with blue chip galleries not just bringing in the usual suspects, but also a brilliant selection of new kids on the block with fresh and imaginative vision. This year's affair will shine a light on the works of Jürgen Teller, William Klein and Taryn Simon, one not to be missed. Our resident photography expert is photo director Matt Beeman, and he joins me now to give us even more reason to head to Somerset House this May. Matt, thanks for joining us on the show.
No problem.
Now, Photo London, we all look forward to it. It's a good party. It's a good thing to go to the opening of. It's a good thing to drop in throughout the week, I suppose, as
absolutely.
Well. As photo director, let's talk about your side of things. What do you get out of it? Do you make new discoveries of photographers? Do you see old favourites? How does it kind of work in your part of the magazine?
There's usually some satellite exhibitions with some new discoveries that I found over the years. And I think there's one coming up this year, which is a group show of contemporary still life photographers, the people like Lucas Blaylock and Sarah Siner, who are kind of up-and-coming American still life photographers. But I think mostly it's kind of old favourites. And I think the lineup of talks they have this year is
so this is good stuff, isn't it? So this is sort of added value. If you've bought your ticket for Photo London, you can go and, you can go and see the things that the galleries have for sale and some of the kind of more curated things. But this is good stuff. This is where you see some of your favourite photographers, big names, interesting practices, interviewed on stage or talking you through their work, right?
Yeah, there's so many good things. So Jürgen Teller is talking, and then Jack Davidson, who's the hot new kind of fashion photographer, he's talking to Kathy Ryan from the New York Times Magazine, who's photography director there. Jürgen's talking to Adrian Searle. There's Thomas Demand giving a talk. William Klein.
Thomas the Demanding Engine.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's what I like to call him. Okay, he's a good boy. Like
yeah, he's great. And then Bruce Davidson, who is kind of mostly famous for his book Subway.
For being an AC/DC.
Yeah, and being an AC/DC.
That's Bruce Dickinson. Is it? Damn.
Wasn't he Iron Maiden?
Iron Maiden. I've gone completely nuts. It's good, isn't it? Maybe he'll come as well.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Yeah,
so he is mostly famous for the book Subway. He shot in the 70s, riding the New York subway for 2 years, I think, on his own, and created this amazing document of life of the New York subway at that time.
And you get, presumably in these talks, you get such an amazing sense of how these things were.
Yeah,
like.
That's
so you get a bit
really
of the artistry of it, but you can kind of see it. You can't really explain the artistry of something, but it's the bloody-mindedness of riding the subway from 5 a.m. every day and taking these pictures.
Yeah.
We'll move on. We'll talk a bit about Photo London, but why is Subway your favourite body of work of a photographer?
I think I've always been interested in reportage, and I think that this kind of took it one step further, the images he got and the kind of people he photographed from all walks of life and all kind of instances. So he captured somebody being threatened with a gun or through to kind of like wealthier members of the kind of New York society. And I think it's been referenced so much since then in fashion shoots, and it has a broader appeal than the sort of social documentary that he set out to do.
Because it's all of human life, is there?
Yeah, it's amazing.
And it's one of those things, before we switched on the microphones, we were sort of saying about the different offerings that galleries have.
Yeah.
Now, you do see a lot of similar things on stands. You know, there are, you name check the classic Averdon prints, which is Averdon prints, which kind of pop up here, there and everywhere. Now, obviously, people like them, presumably
they sell.
You know, if you're on the committee of Photo London, what might you do to steer it down a bit more of a kind of artistically, sort of astute route, or less of the kind of usual suspects route?
I think I try to encourage some of the smaller international galleries, M&B Art in LA, people like that. Who are championing some really interesting contemporary photography. I'm not sure if they're there this year or not, but I just think giving a platform to some of those guys as well as the kind of more established, bigger galleries would be a way to keep that balance.
And I suppose maybe, you know, the bigger gallery showing their smaller artists.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a funny thing. Yeah. And some of the smaller galleries, you know, being able to highlight some of their bigger artists or their more successful works. It's always that funny thing when, the more minor, you know, the smaller galleries tend to put on more risk-taking shows than the big galleries, which could afford to.
And it's true.
Frieze last year actually saw the opposite. The bigger galleries were kind of putting on riskier shows, which is quite nice to see. Paris Photo is a big deal. The New York Photography Festival is big. Photo London, it seems like it was high time for it to launch when it launched in 2015. It's obviously been very successful. Do you think that photography, when it's exhibited at a general run-of-the-mill art fair, I say run-of-the-mill, but it's not specifically a photophy art fair, a Frieze or an Art Basel or something like that. Mm-hmm. Do you think photography gets lost? I mean, you mentioned the work of photographers that are on M&B's roster. Mm. Now, Benjamin's artists there very much kind of blur the lines between a photograph and an artwork, and they might use photography, but in a very opaque, odd way.
Yeah.
Do you think that, I'm sure you'll say yes, but do you think that a specific photo fair is required, or B, that it gets lost when it's part of a larger nondescript art fair?
Yeah, I think it does sometimes often get lost, actually. I think it kind of needs its own platform. And I think that's why festivals like Arles have been so successful, and IER Festival in the south of France as well, and Unseen, which are kind of lower, I guess, level photography festivals, but really, really good and influential. I think they kind of need their own context.
Need a bit of a leg up.
Yeah, I think so.
Somehow. I mean, photography is also, it's a very sellable part of the food chain of the art world, isn't it? I mean, it's, I think when you see photography on the walls of contemporary art galleries, if it's not a Sugimoto or something like that, it's quite readily sellable stuff, which I suppose is the same thing that takes you back to having Averdon's on the wall of every booth.
Yeah. And I guess it's a bit more accessible.
It's playing the hits.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Well, get yourself down to Photo London. When's it on, Matt?
18th to 21st of May.
He sounds like a proper spokesman there for Photo London. Yeah. Well, listen, power to it. They're friends of ours. And I'll see you down the front for Subway.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Can't wait.
Thanks to Matt Beeman, bringing us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture. My producer was Holly Hay, Festival Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds. And thanks for tuning in.